This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we always welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Ordinarily at this point I would ask you to hold your calls because, we want you to hear what our guest has to say, but apparently our guest is not going to be available this evening. We've left a message on his answering machine, but he's not responded. We only have one number for him. We were going to have Daniel Sheehan on, and Daniel Sheehan is a liberal, but a very brilliant and intelligent individual who's been involved in many important lawsuits. He certainly was the legal counsel for, Dr. Greer, I think that was his name, who put on a very important meeting on UFOs back in Washington, D.C. Some years ago, where they had people from high positions in government who were willing to come forward and violate their oaths of secrecy and let the American people know that the government really did have information on UFOs. Now, I believe that these are demonic manifestations. I believe that they tie into the other dimension. Mr. Sheehan probably wouldn't agree with me on that, but I thought it would be well worthwhile your hearing his information. However, since he doesn't appear to be with us this evening, we are going to have open lines, and we don't... Hello? This is Dr. Stan, and I don't know why nothing seems to be coming through. I'm going to have find out why our programs are not seem to be. There we are. Okay, fine. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlying beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, and. This is the time when ordinarily we would just tell you that we would welcome your calls, but hold your calls because we certainly are waiting for our guest. But we don't have a special guest tonight. He hasn't actually shown up. So we're going to simply have open lines. If you'd like to give us a call, why give us a call? Otherwise, why is going to be a monologue here put on for the next hour? Actually, 2 hours, because Mr. Sheehan was be with us for 2 hours. So I'm going to start out by telling you what Abraham Lincoln said on January 27, 1838, when he addressed the Lyceum in Springfield, Illinois. And Abraham Lincoln said this, at what point, well, you're going to have to wait, we'll get to this in just a moment right here at Radio Liberty. Well, Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were going, of course, to open the program this evening, since it's going to be a monologue, and I will be waiting for your calls here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, with the quotation from Abraham Lincoln. And, of course, Abraham Lincoln addressed the Lyceum in Springfield, Illinois, on January 27th, 1838, and this is what he said. At what point should we expect the approach of danger? By what means should we fortify ourselves against it? Should we expect some transatlantic military giant to step the ocean and crush us with a blow? Never. All the armies of Europe and Asia and Africa combined could not by force take a drink from the Ohio or make a track on the Blue Ridge in a trial of 1,000 years. Then at what point, then, is the approach of danger to be expected? And I answer, if it ever reaches, it must spring up among us. It cannot come from abroad. If destruction be our lot, we ourselves must be its authors and its finishers. As the nation of free men, we shall live through all time or die by suicide. And I really feel very, very strongly that we face the loss of freedom here in the United States, because I think we are dying by suicide. I think we've embraced financial policies that will destroy this nation. I think we've embraced moral policies that will destroy this nation. I believe that we have really been taken over as a nation by dark and sinister spiritual forces, and the good people of America, and the majority of the people are good. I have no idea what is really happening, why so many things just don't make sense, why our government refuses to address the issue of illegal immigration, why our government is doing everything they can to build up the economy of communist China, and it is communist China, and yet, of course, communist China is one of the greatest threats to the peace of the Far East and of the United States today. Why it is that the United States continues funneling money to Russia when, well, Russia, at least potentially, is our major adversary, because despite the fact we've been told that communism is gone, Russia still has an arsenal of nuclear weapons that could annihilate and destroy this country within a matter of just a few minutes. Well, we're going to start taking some calls, because we don't have our ordinary guests scheduled for this evening. We're going to do open lines, and, well, I don't know what happened to Roger, and we had Michael from Kentucky, and I don't know what happened to Michael from Kentucky. So we're going to have Linda from Spokane. If the other people would like to call back, they may have gotten into some problems there. Anyway, if Roger wants to call back and Michael wants to call back from Kentucky, and hopefully we'll have Linda on here in just a couple of minutes and talk about what she wants to talk about. But I think it's so vitally important that the American people begin reassessing what's going on in America and try to understand it. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Right now we seem to be having some problems. People are calling in, and we seem to be actually losing them as soon as they come on, so hopefully Mike can keep the people from dropping off. Under any circumstances, our regularly scheduled guest isn't here. And I started out simply talking about the incredible financial policies that America is involved in. If you look and see what's happening, it would appear that the leaders of this government are intent upon destroying the financial stability of our nation. I can feel no other possible explanation for the massive deficit spending we've undertaken. In the year 2000, we're running a very, very small deficit. Now, they were told you we were running a surplus. We really weren't, because we were still stealing from Social Security, but budget was at least somewhat moving towards being balanced, and yet, of course, today, why we seem to have moved into massive deficits, where we are spending 6% more than we're producing, And you can't keep doing that indefinitely. What we've got, is this Linda from Spokane, or who do we have on the line?
You have Roger.
All right, Roger from Allentown. Hi, Roger. How are you?
Thanks, Dr. Stan. Yeah, I've been wanting to ask for some time, when you, a few days back, I heard, I guess it was a rebroadcast when they had you on Freedom 21. And, and I heard Tom DeWeese is going to be the chairing or whatever, the Freedom 21 in Reno.
Right.
Coming up. I hadn't heard anyone else mention that, but that's I thought very encouraging. Anyway, I've been wanting to ask you since that show if you might share my skepticism or took it as probably true when it came out, the admission that the engineering studies for Yucca Mountain nuclear waste disposal site were falsified. That is, do you think maybe either the studies might actually have been good enough, or also that they might have been based on unreasonably long requirements for more than so many tens of thousands of years of integrity against any leaking in the groundwater or whatever?
Well, I think, first of all, Roger, you have to realize that there has been an organized, coordinated effort to block the use of nuclear power for over 40 years here in the United States. I mean, nuclear power is certainly the safest form and most efficient and most economical form of electricity that there is available in the world today. That's why the Chinese communists are building plants, and we're financing the plants in communist China. We're guaranteeing the loan so they can build $5 billion to build the first five of some 50 nuclear plants that they're going to build for the Chinese communists in China. Certainly, France gets 80% of her nuclear power of her electricity from nuclear power. I think Japan probably gets 30 or 40% from nuclear power. We should have had nuclear power a long time ago, but of course, it was effectively blocked. And the use of nuclear power was blocked by the environmental movement, which was financed in large part by the establishment and by the oil industry. So they did not want nuclear power. And the people who had invested in nuclear power 40 years ago, most of them have gone bankrupt. And so the nuclear industry has shifted from weak hands into strong hands. And now that it is in strong hands, suddenly, again, there is talk about the necessity of nuclear power. Now, one of the justifications that was given why we couldn't have nuclear power is, shucks, we just don't know what to do with the nuclear waste. And there have been talks for a long period of time where we should put the nuclear waste. And then they came up with this thing about Yucca Mountain. Now, they're going to put the nuclear waste, my understanding, is put it into glass. And once it's put into glass, you just don't have to worry about it. It's not going to create a problem at all. There in Yucca Mountain, why you have very little rainfall, and I'm sure it'll be safe there for, you know, the next 10,000 or 20,000 years. Remember, all nuclear material comes out of the ground. It's mined. So certainly if there's a danger of getting into water, it could get into water from the mines. Wherever the uranium deposits are, it can get into water. The thing that should have been done a long time ago, if we'd wanted to do what France and what Germany and what Japan and all the other countries do, is recycle our nuclear waste. We've never been allowed to do that. This whole scam about, oh my goodness, we just can't have nuclear power, why we don't even know what to do with the waste, why they falsified the records at Yucca Mountain. I really believe that this is all part of the scam to keep us from developing nuclear power in America. And only within the last couple of weeks has suddenly everything shifted. And I suspect that probably before long, you're going to find out, oh, shucks, well, maybe that analysis for Yucca Mountain wasn't so bad. And we're going to have to go ahead and develop nuclear power, and we're going to be allowed to reprocess the waste. It is all part of a scam. They're playing games with our mind. Every other country in the world reprocesses their nuclear fuel. We're just not allowed to do it here in the United States. We've created all this unnecessary nuclear fuel. Much of this could still be reprocessed and used over again. And I think it's going to happen. I think there's suddenly been a paradigm shift within the last month that is going to allow us to develop nuclear power.
Yeah, I lived just a mile or two away from Scotland's nuclear reprocessing facility in Dounreay, and I didn't see anybody glowing up there.
Right. Okay, anything else, Roger?
Yeah, I thought either the two, Yucca Mountain, I forget the other one, were probably more than adequately safe. They had these unreasonably long the time frame. But of course, the last thing the liberals want to do is see a safe repository for this waste.
But remember, this is not financed by the liberals. The liberals, the environmentalists, are simply being financed in this whole thing by the establishment. This whole thing has been created. The power of the environmentalists has never been their own power. It has always been that of the establishment, of the media, and of the great industry. So they have financed the environmental movement to block nuclear power, and now with the oil shortage and the paradigm shift, I think that you're going to hear increasingly that we're just going to have nuclear power.
Yeah,
they're talking about building new refineries here in this country after having blocked oil refineries for 23 years. We have not built one oil refinery in the United States for 23 years.
Well,
Why would you do something that stupid unintentionally?
Yeah, we have the scandal of all these and huge expense of these leaking cans sitting in pools of water.
You're talking about the spent nuclear fuel.
Well, yeah, and other waste that are just sitting in rusting drums, which is it's better than nothing, but really drives up the cost and all. God bless, Dr. Stan.
God bless. Thanks so much. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. If you're out there in the audience, we'd love to hear from you. And we're just going to do open lines for the next 2 hours. And we've got Michael calling from Kentucky about aliens. Okay, Michael, did you have a question or comment?
You've actually distracted me from that topic to the nuclear fuel thing. It's been about 5 years ago on one of the Alphabet Soup news networks, back when I watched a lot more of the, CNN,
right,
and NBC. And a report of a guy who had developed a way to use the residual heat from steel smelting, and he was injecting nuclear waste into the slag, the waste slag material that's coming out of these new micro steel, the super small steel smelters and plants, And it renders it's sort of like what you were talking about by injecting it into glass. It renders it essentially inert and unable to react. So it's a lot easier to isolate it and keep it from going into the environment. So they could store it in, these vast salt mines that have been abandoned or out in Yucca Mountain or anywhere.
Well, see, the thing is, we first should reprocess it, because you can, you can reduce the volume of the spent nuclear fuel probably by 98-99%.
Well, essentially, you are reprocessing,
right,
it by injecting into a plasma of superheated slag. It ends up causing it to become bonded with that slag. But, it's like some of the weird science stuff you read in, at Popular Mechanics or Popular Science or something. You read about this phenomenal development, and then you never hear about it. Did it ever get used? Did it ever get implemented? What happened? It's like there's a controlled release of technology, and I think that could be a good segue into the space alien stuff, whether or not there's actually space aliens, and whether or not they've reverse-engineered space alien technology, they can still use that as a good little psychological operation, to play around with people's perceptions of reality, I think. And there's been some suggestions that they've done that with certain subjects, where they take and try to make people into, experiment on them under whatever it is, Title 50 United States Code, where they can experiment on the public as long as they notify the local civil authorities or something. They got a law for everything they want to do.
Well, they always want to do this under the color of law, but they've been experimenting on American servicemen for years, which is why I would never want my son or my grandson going in the military, or my granddaughters going in, because they will experiment on them, and they've done irreparable harm to many of our servicemen, using them as human guinea pigs, which is what they did in the Gulf War, and of course what we know that they did, in the 1950s, and they've experimented on the children in the orphanages, and of course, we know what the Tuskegee study was, the plutonium studies that were done, where, of course, they fed the orphans, uranium and plutonium, just to see what would happen. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. On the Lincoln assassination thing, or the Lincoln suicide comment that you had, I think we've recently had more than a few suspicious Arkansides, and what was the journalist's name that recently supposedly committed suicide?
Gary...
Gary Webb and
Gary
the
Webb,
other,
right? He shot himself the other guy, twice
Hunter,
in the head.
Hunter Thompson also, I think, is kind of a little bit of a weird one. But I think Lincoln's comment is a little out of context when you consider that you can easily put the gun in the hand of the victim.
Well, we're going to be back. Why don't you hang on? We'll be glad to talk about this whole issue of aliens, because it really is very significant and very apropos to everything going on today. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you'd like to give us a call. And we're going to be open lines for the next 2 hours. We have a gentleman calling in, Michael calling in from Kentucky, I believe. Is that Kentucky, right?
Yeah, the Commonwealth or state of, whichever it is, I can't figure it out, but
Well, first of all, I think that it's important to realize that I do not believe that these are space aliens. However, I believe that UFOs are real, because I know too many people who've actually seen them, and I've read enough information from very reliable people that there is an entity out there, that something happens, these have the ability to materialize and dematerialize and violate the laws of physics. I mean, they can be going, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 miles and suddenly turn right. You can't do that.
Yeah.
Not if you are, of course, working in this dimension.
If you're dealing with the time, you know, if you're able to manipulate time, then it might appear to us in our linear time that they've made a right angle turn, you know. But I think that has been suggested is that you know, the Nazis or whoever was working with playing around with manipulating time long before, you know, we were ever. And there's a movie made about the Philadelphia experiment where they played around with accidentally discovering ways to move instantly through space or some such, you know.
I think what you have to understand, Michael, is that this is all accessing the other dimension. Now, there are a lot of people who realize that there is another dimension out there and that you can access this. And this is why, of course, Art Bell's program, George Norrie's programs have such tremendous a fascination for people. People know that there's something out there. What they do not understand, however, this is a spiritual realm.
Well,
and this is really a demonic realm. And I personally believe that the Greys, entities that have been described by so many people who've been victims of alien abductions, really are demonic beings.
It's an old tactic. The devil would love to convince you that he doesn't exist or that he's something else. Oh, yes, he's a gray space alien, yeah.
You go back and you read the Bible, and they tell you that at the time of Noah, there were fallen angels who came to Earth, and they cohabited with women, and they had offspring. They were known as Nephilim.
Well, the sons of God, I think, is the expression in the King James,
right?
Isn't it?
Right. But
the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were good for wives, and they made themselves wives of the daughters of men, or whatever.
But of course, I think that is a small g, not the sons of the God of the heaven. Mm. But it's a small g.
There's a lot of different names for Yahweh or YHWH, Elohim, whatever that is simply translated as God or Jehovah in the Old Testament.
But I don't think that these were the sons of the God of the Bible. I believe that these were fallen angels, and I believe that it was because of the evil that they promoted that God, of course, destroyed the earth at the time of Noah.
The book of Job and Jacob's Ladder shows that at one time, you know, during a certain time frame in the Bible, angels were allowed to go back and forth. Even, you know, Satan came before, or Lucifer came before God, Yahweh, or Jehovah, and asked, you know, he said, look, you know, this man Job, I can break him.
No, hold that. We're going to just have to bring him. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Michael is calling, and our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. I honestly believe that we are seeing manifestations of this other dimension. And I believe that there is tremendous knowledge there that we can tap into, but I don't think we should be tapping into it. I believe that there are people working within our government who've been trying to tap into the this supernatural power that is from the other dimension. We even have a video, a very, very good production called Deceived, and it stars Lou Gossett Jr., and it's the story of how our military is trying to tap into the other dimension, and I believe that they are, and I believe this is really what all this is about, is trying to tap into the other dimension to get this supernatural power so we can use this for our military advantage. And once you begin tapping into this other dimension, of course, you're leaving yourself open to demonic possession.
You're speaking of things like remote viewing that
right.
the CIA has actually spent
right.
who knows how many tens
right.
of millions of dollars on.
Right. Absolutely. Hey, we've got another caller on the line. Do you have another point you'd like to make?
Well, I was just pointing out that I think that in the Old Covenant or the Old Testament or the Torah that there is a time frame there where apparently Lucifer or Satan, however he's known as, he was allowed to approach the throne, I guess, and in the book of Job it's described that he's, you know, God basically told him, all right, yeah, go ahead, try this man, you can't break him, and, you know, kind of had like a little contest there, and they couldn't break Job. And, of course, some people look at that book and say, you know, it's just a fable or whatever, just like they look at the story of Jonah and try to say that it was meant to be humor or it was a fable. But I think it really happened, and I think there's lessons to be learned from reading that. But when you're talking about the earth, I think you can equate it to a plane of existence. There are those who try to, you know, the Flat Earth Society that try to say that the earth is flat. But when you're talking about space aliens making right angles, you know, and people have actually witnessed that, I think you know, there are certainly things that can't even come up with a unified theory for physics yet to equate, you know, the micro, what do they call that, subatomic physics along with Einstein's relativity. They can't even come up with that. So for the scientists or for anybody to be so arrogant to think that you know, these UFOs are evidence of extraterrestrial life, I think they're really not looking at the whole picture.
Okay, well, thanks so very much.
All righty.
Let's go to Jesse calling from Spokane. Hi, did you have a question, comment?
Yes, you once mentioned that Winston Churchill started the civilian bombing of Germany,
yes.
and then the Germans retaliated by continuing.
The Germans retaliated by bombing Coventry. And, of course, we had broken the code. We knew they were going to bomb Coventry, or at least the British did. And Winston Churchill did not warn the people. It did not evacuate the city. So there would be a maximum number of people killed because he felt that once that were to happen, then America would come into the war. FDR had promised Winston Churchill that if the Germans started bombing British cities, that we would come into the war. This would give him a justification for bringing America into the war. And so Churchill started bombing German cities. Then when the Germans retaliated and were going to hit Coventry, why Churchill specifically did not warn the people, did not evacuate the city, and left them there to die. Now, the justification for that was, well, we couldn't let the Germans know we'd broken the code, and if they evacuated Coventry, the Germans would know that we left the code. But contrary to what most people believe, Winston Churchill was a very evil man who had no loyalty at all to Great Britain. He had loyalty to this whole internationalist dream of a new world order and a new world religion. He was a Druid. He was involved with Masonry during the First World War, why he insisted on the invasion of Gallipoli, which led to the death of about 160,000 British troops and almost a similar number of Turkish troops. He intensely prolonged the Second World War because we were ready to invade Europe in 1943. And I was told this by General Albert Wedemeyer, who was in charge of planning at that time for the military, and Churchill absolutely refused to allow us to invade Europe and end the war. Instead, he insisted on a senseless invasion of North Africa. Contrary to everything you've read, why Winston Churchill was an evil, evil little man.
Yeah, I was talking to my grandpa about that, and he wanted to know the source you had for that for Winston Churchill ordering that. Could you give me a source?
Well, now, which specific thing? The invasion of Gallipoli? Withholding the invasion of Europe? Or withholding the information on Coventry?
For bombing the civilian populations of Germany, it was the British who started it first.
All right, fine. We're going to have to have you, I'll give you to my call screener, and we'll get your name and address, and we'll find that and get it for you, okay?
Okay.
Okay, and you just sort of hang on the line there.
Okay.
Oh, we're just about out of time. Go ahead. Hang right on there.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest, our guest didn't show up this evening, so it's going to be you and me. And if you'd like, of course, to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We actually have an article that was published in the Wall Street Journal called Bye Bye Woodrow. And it was written by Arthur Schlesinger Jr. It was written in October of 1993, and it's actually contained within my sustainable development syllabus. And here, of course, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. is talking about this idea of establishing a world government. And he goes on to say that let's not kid ourselves that we can have a new world order without paying for it in blood as well as in money. And it may be very well that it's going to be too costly to have this new world order, to have this world government. But remember, if we abandon this concept, and he's of course referring to the concept that Woodrow Wilson had actually advocated back in 1918, this idea of establishing a world government. Why, basically, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. said, if we were to abandon this idea, we would forego that wonderful dream that was put forward in the words of Lord Tennyson, "For I dipped into the future, far as any eye could see, saw a vision of the world and all the wonders that would be, had the heavens filled with shouting and there rained a ghastly doom, of the nation's airy navies grappling in the central bloom, till the war drums throbbed no longer and the battle flags were furled in the Parliament of Man, the Federation of the World." And then Arthur Schlesinger went on to say that Winston Churchill said that those were the most noble words ever written. And Harry Truman carried those words with him, that poem with him, in his wallet all of his adult life. Now, why would Winston Churchill support this idea put forward by Tennyson and the Parliament of Man and the Federation of the World? And it's really very simple, because Winston Churchill was dedicated to this idea of world government. And the whole idea has been around, well, it goes back to 1842 when Tennyson wrote that poem. It was called Locksley Hall, but of course it antedated that. It goes really back literally thousands and thousands of years. And of course you can get my newsletter, I think it was my September or October newsletter of last year, where we of course go into the background of this whole idea of the world government. And we simply quoted from the writings of Manly P. Hall, who was a Luciferian. And this, of course, comes from page 2 of my October 2004 newsletter, where Manly P. Hall said, "For more than 3,000 years, secret societies have labored to create the background of knowledge necessary to the establishment of an enlightened democracy among the nations of the world. Today's thinking towards a democratic world state is neither a new trend nor an accidental circumstance. The work of setting up the background of knowledge necessary to the establishment of enlightened democracy among all nations has been carried on for many hundreds of years by secret societies." Well, of course, you have to understand that Winston Churchill was part of a secret society. He certainly was a Mason. He was a Druid, and of course this is a very, very special secret society. It exists in Great Britain. It has for literally thousands of years, and of course it was the Druids who were involved with the worship at the Stonehenge, this ancient Druid worship center in Great Britain. And the great tragedy, you know, of so much of what's going on today is that people honestly believe what they've read in the media about Winston Churchill. Yes, he was a brilliant man, but he was also a traitor to Great Britain. Oh, yes, everybody thought he did such a wonderful job of rallying England against the Nazis. But you see, Adolf Hitler was deeply involved in the occult, and so was Winston Churchill. And when the war ended, and you can find this reference in a book called Spiritual Politics, written by Corrine McLaughlin and Gordon Davidson, why Winston Churchill prevailed upon the prosecutors at Nuremberg not to bring up any of the fact that the entire force that was energizing the Nazi movement was the occult. Why? Because Winston Churchill didn't want people to understand the occult background of the Nazi movement, of the SS, of Adolf Hitler, of his murder of the Jews, because this, of course, carries on the ideas of Madame Blavatsky and so many of the others who were involved in Theosophy with an intense hatred of the Jews. They wanted to create an Aryan world nation and destroy other people, the other races. The Aryans were to rule the world. That was the plan, and certainly why Winston Churchill was going right along with that, exactly the same thing that Adolf Hitler wanted to do. And of course, this was simply a trial. This was an effort to bring about a new world order. I think it was more of a trial to see how far they could get with it. I don't know how many of you remember the movie, The Sound of Music, but on and one of the areas there, they're having this wonderful party at the Von Trapp home, and one of the Nazis comes up to Captain Von Trapp and says, of course, you will be supporting the new order, won't you? And, of course, this is what it was all about, this whole idea of a new world order that Adolf Hitler wanted, and George Bush wants, and Bill Clinton wants, and Mikhail Gorbachev wants. And if you doubt that these men are all pushing for a new world order, we've got a wonderful video. It's called Amazing Clips, and you can even get the very short version of that, the 9 or 10 minute. You'll actually hear George Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, talking about the new world order, and of course Gorbachev talking about the new world order, and Bill Clinton talking about the new world order. It is the common goal of all of the people who are working behind the scenes. It was the goal and objective of both Adolf Hitler and of Winston Churchill, the Parliament of Man, the Federation of the World. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. We have Bill from New York. Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Doing all right.
What part are you living in? Upstate New York or New York City, or where are you calling?
I'm Syracuse.
Okay, very good. So you're hearing it there on the big FM station?
No, I listen to you on the shortwave.
Okay, very good. Well, whatever way you can listen, we're glad to have you with us. Do you have a question or comment this evening?
Well, one thing I've been hearing a lot about on some other shortwave programs, and I wanted to make sure that your listeners know about it too. The so-called Real ID Act was just passed in the Senate this past week.
Unanimously, right?
Yep, all 100 of them. I expected it to pass, but I didn't expect every last one of them to vote for it.
Well, but you have to understand how they sold it. They sold it to the senators as, this is how we're going to control immigration. And the people are upset about immigration, and you don't want to favor illegal immigration, do you? Well, of course you wouldn't. I mean, the people would be mad at you. So you vote for this act because this is how we're going to control illegal immigration. And I would like to suggest this has nothing to do with controlling immigration, illegal immigration, because there's nothing in that act that says that, you know, that the police are going to have to report illegal immigrants to the INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service. It's not going to strengthen the situation along the border. It is simply a means of having an ID card for law-abiding American citizens, and I share your concern about it, but it just goes to show how effective these people are in controlling our duly elected representatives.
Right. I just wish people would put their thinking caps on and realize they were so concerned about immigration, instead of sending troops halfway around the world to impose the New World Order, they put some of them along the borders.
But you see, they don't want to stop illegal immigration. They want to create the problem so they can come up with a solution. That's what it's all about. And the solution takes away our freedom. And you have to only see what's happening. I mean, we've created a situation to act as a magnet to draw these people across the border. I mean, they can come here, and if they're caught in violation of our laws, they're not punished for it. They can come here and they can get free medical care. And now you'll be happy to know that within the last week, why the federal government has said that they're going to pay the hospitals for providing free medical care for illegal aliens. Why aren't the hospitals required to report them to the Immigration and Naturalization Service so they can be deported? Because they do not want to solve the problem. In fact, they have organizations for the illegal immigrants, illegal aliens coming to this country, LULAC and NALDEV, and do you know who's financing them? They're being financed by the Ford Foundation. They want to create the problem. This is why they give them subsidized education, and if you are an illegal immigrant and you are actually living in California, you can go to our colleges and have your education subsidized. You get the lower rate than an American citizen coming into California from Nevada.
I've heard they can do the same thing up here in New York, too.
Right. And, of course, you have to understand they want the problem, because if they didn't have the problem, how could they justify coming up with solutions like the Real ID Act? Hey, our caller just showed up, our special guest for this evening. But anything else you want to say before we go to Daniel Sheehan?
No, I just basically wanted to make sure that I just wanted to get the word out.
God bless you. Thanks so much for calling.
You're welcome.
Okay. Well, we're glad to have you here, Daniel. How are you tonight?
Good. I just got off an airplane.
All right, fine. Well, I'm glad you got here. And so why don't you sort of, for our listeners who do not know who you are, and we have, of course, listeners all across America that do not know who Daniel Sheehan is. So tell us who you are and how you came to be involved as you are.
Well, all right, yeah. I graduated from Harvard College in 1967. I studied there during the time of Henry Kissinger teaching foreign policy and James Schlesinger teaching history, and Ibn Reischauer was teaching Far Eastern policy in that crowd. That was the time when I was there, and I graduated in 1967, having studied all of those fields.
Was Howard Phillips there at that time when you were there?
No, he wasn't there.
Okay.
But then I was the Rhodes Scholar nominee from Harvard College in 1967, and then went on to Harvard Law School.
Well, did you take a Rhodes Scholarship?
Well, I got drafted.
Oh, I see, okay.
United States Army. And then I ended up going to Harvard Law School, where I was the an editor of the Harvard Civil Rights Law Review, and was the chief researcher for Professor Jerome Cohen, who was the head of the International Law Department at Harvard, and worked in Bobby Kennedy's campaign during that time, 1968, until he was assassinated, and ended up graduating from Harvard Law School in 1970, and went on to the Wall Street law firm, the number one Wall Street law firm, Cahill Gordon, where I served as one of the legal counsel for the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case, and got to be one of the persons that reviewed all 47 volumes of the classified documents in the Pentagon Papers.
What was that, about 1972?
That was the 71.
71, okay.
And then went on to the law firm of F. Lee Bailey, where I was one of the special counsel to the Boston law office of F. Lee Bailey when we did the Watergate burglary case. We represented, defended the major wiretap specialist, James McCord, and he's the one that, you remember, wrote the letter to Judge Sirica blowing the whistle on the plumbers and Richard Nixon. And in the course of that case, I came to learn what it was that the Watergate burglary was all about and what its connections were, and went on from there to Harvard Divinity School, where I did my master's work and PhD work in comparative social ethics, and went on to become chief counsel for the United States Jesuit headquarters for the Jesuit Order in Washington, D.C. And there I became legal counsel in the Karen Silkwood case, represented the Karen Silkwood family in the major lawsuit over the nuclear plutonium facility in Oklahoma that they did the movie about with Meryl Streep and Cher and the others, and came to discover that that the plant was smuggling 98% pure bomb-grade plutonium to Israel with the assistance of the Central Intelligence Agency to give nuclear weapons to Israel.
Yeah.
And then went on from that case to work and become a chief counsel in the for the American Sanctuary Movement that represented the case which revealed the connections between the Reagan-Bush administration and the secret covert war of the Contras in Central America. And that opened up the whole Iran-Contra case, where I became chief counsel in the Iran-Contra case that revealed the underground smuggling of weapons to the Contras by the Reagan-Bush administration when the United States Congress had passed the Boland Amendment prohibiting them from supporting the Contras. That led to the whole Iran-Contra crisis and the appointment of Lawrence Walsh, the special prosecutor.
Now, when we talked earlier, didn't you say that one reason you left F.D. Bailey's law firm was because you found they were tied into the CIA?
That's right. That's right. That in fact, attorney Lee Bailey ended up, I discovered, was actually taking the case because he was on a short index called Index 4, of a list of attorneys that would defend American Central Intelligence Agency operatives when they were engaged in unconstitutional conduct in the United States in violation of the National Security Act.
And, of course, there are laws that say the CIA can't operate here.
That's
and
right.
It readily violates these laws with impunity, and nobody's ever really punished for
violating
the
laws. Well, that's right,
the
because the problem is, of course, that it's a criminal violation, and the federal executive branch and the president's office are in charge of the Justice Department that does any prosecuting. And so when their own Central Intelligence Agency violates the law, they simply refuse to prosecute them by exercising their own discretion, not prosecutorial discretion, not to prosecute them. So there's really no effective law enforcement system against the Central Intelligence Agency.
Except, of course, with Watergate. And I've often wondered, well, I have my own opinions as to why, but
yeah.
Why, of course, didn't they simply get the Justice Department to drop the prosecution of these people and the investigation? You know, you would think that Nixon would have brought pressure to do that. He would have had enough power. He could have got the Justice Department not to prosecute
well,
the
burglary. Well,
he did.
What he did is, as you recall, in the famous June 23rd smoking gun tape, the June 23rd conversation between John Dean, his legal counsel, and Bob Haldeman, his chief of staff, with President Nixon at the time, Nixon did, in fact, give them an order to have the Central Intelligence Agency to actually go over and to contact the FBI and tell the FBI to stop the investigation. And the question that arose is, how did that order leak out so that the president ended up being indicted, in effect, and impeached for attempting to obstruct justice? And that became a very major issue, and there's lots of details to that, but the bottom line on it is that the reason that happened is because the Central Intelligence Agency, in this particular case, Vernon Walters and Dick Helms, Dick Helms being the director of the CIA at that time, and Vernon Walters the special deputy director, they viewed President Nixon's order to them to stop the Watergate investigation as being a threat that he was making to the Central Intelligence Agency, that if they didn't use their power to stop the investigation in Watergate, that Nixon would take steps to reveal the fact that the Central Intelligence Agency was involved in setting up the political assassination team to kill Fidel Castro, which is in fact the group that killed President Kennedy. And they viewed this as a threat, and because of that, what they did is they pulled the plug on him. And so they started giving information over to Robert Bennett, who was Deep Throat, the man who is now one of the two United States senators from the state of Utah. Robert Bennett was Deep Throat, and he's the one that started shuffling information to Bob Woodward over at the Washington Post, because though people don't know it, Bob Woodward, immediately prior to coming out at the Washington Post, as you recall, he was hired at the Washington Post directly from having been the point briefer for U.S. Naval Intelligence to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he was hired over there by the new publisher at the Washington Post, who had been for 8 years a full-time Central Intelligence Agency officer out in Langley. And so it was an inside job that the Central Intelligence Agency pulled the plug on Nixon by leaking information through the Washington Post publicly to expose Nixon's role in shuffling money to the plumbers to try to silence them.
In other words, it was the Central Intelligence Agency that brought down the presidency.
That's exactly right.
All right, before I want you to go on, but yes. We are going to, of course, be losing some of our listeners up there in the Washington area, so I want you to know who we're listening to. We're listening to Daniel Sheehan, and he's going to be speaking at the Conspiracy Conference, which is going to be held in the Santa Clara area in California, just north of San Jose, just short north of where I live. He's going to be there on the 28th and 29th of this month, a two-day Conspiracy Conference. A lot of fascinating people are going to be there speaking, but Daniel's going to be there speaking. If you'd like to know more about the Conspiracy Conference, the number is 209-832-0999. That's 209-832-999. If you'd like more information, I'm not going to be speaking. I am going to have a booth. I know there'd be a lot of people there that I would disagree with, but there'll be a lot of people there I would agree with, and people like Mr. Sheehan has such an important story to tell. He has been part of the history of what's happened here at the last 30 years and has an important story to tell. We'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up this evening's program. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Daniel Sheehan, and of course, it's his contention, and I certainly agree with him, that the Central Intelligence Agency brought Richard Nixon down. I mean, this information could have been suppressed. It was not. And of course, then coordinating with the media, and I think the media was like a feeding frenzy, and of course, they were out to get Richard Nixon, and of course, Richard Nixon was not a very nice man. I mean, contrary to everything you've heard, I believe, of course, the fact that he lied about the men that we abandoned in Vietnam. Richard Nixon was not a man of integrity and certainly not fit to be the President of the United States. He was a brilliant individual, but there were many reasons, and I think probably the least of all important ones was Watergate, but of course it's that brought him down. I could forgive him for Watergate. I could never forgive him for abandoning the men in Vietnam, which he did. In fact, he prolonged that war for 4 useless years just so he could get reelected in 1972. That is not the thing an honorable person would do, but pick up your story there, Daniel.
Well, as I say, the interesting fact was that when he and we all recall, if we go back kind of in history together, I pointed out that I had been at Harvard Law School and was working for Bobby Kennedy in 1968, trying to get him to run against Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson had accelerated the war in Vietnam, had lied, as was revealed in the Pentagon Papers, was deeply involved in fabricating the story, the false story of the Bay of Tonkin, arguing that our USS Henry Knox, a radar picket destroyer, had been fired upon by the PT boats from North Vietnam, whereas in fact the internal records showed that there was a conscious attempt to instigate some kind of an attack on a U.S. ship, that they actually sent the USS Henry Knox up and down the coast of North Vietnam firing these guns onto the shore to try to solicit some kind of a response, to use it as a justification for attacking and invading into Vietnam, and that because of that, Johnson had gotten himself deeply embroiled in that war, and that was in 1965. By 1968, he'd gotten in so deeply that he couldn't figure out what to do about it, a lot of us in the country were trying to mount some kind of opposition against him and within the Democratic Party. We were trying to get Bobby Kennedy to run against him. Bobby would not run against him. And so a number of us worked at it to go up and get Eugene McCarthy, who was a senator of Minnesota, to get him to come in. And he came in and challenged Johnson for the Democratic nomination. And he made such a powerful run.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course we're talking with Daniel Sheehan, and we'll have him here with us for this next hour. But this is the time when I need to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. And if you listen to our programs and you enjoy what you hear and you think you're going to get information here that you're not going to get elsewhere, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And you can join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. You can certainly get our monthly newsletter. Or if you'd even like to just get a free copy of our newsletter, we'd be glad to send you one free of charge. Our April newsletter actually goes into the background of the drug industry. The fact that in 1999, Merck Company released a Vioxx on the public, a drug that was known before it was ever released to increase the incidence of heart attack 7 times with low-dose Vioxx. The government knew it. The Merck officials knew it, and they released it anyway, and then they kept running more experiments on the American people. Basically, all we've done is take David Graham's testimony before the United States Senate in November of last year, testimony which was largely censored or altered or changed, so the American people didn't really know what was said. You knew he said something, and he created quite a furor, but you never knew what he really said. Well, we've simply taken his official testimony, and that is the essence of our April newsletter, the information you're not going to get elsewhere, and then explaining why the people in the FDA did what they did. Some people say, oh, well, they were on the take. They were getting money, and I'm sure some of them were. But I believe there's another agenda. So if you'd like a free copy of my newsletter, my April newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And let me suggest several of the books that we do carry. One, of course, is called The Truth About the Drug Industry, written by Marshall Angel. Dr. Marshall Angel, former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, currently holding a staff position on the Harvard Medical School. I know certainly no right-wing fanatic. And yet the story she tells you about what they are doing to your health and to the health of your children is must-reading for everybody else. The truth about the drug industry is available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then if I could also suggest, I hope many of you will want to get a book on fluoridation, water fluoridation. Most people sort of shrug and say, why are you worried about that? I mean, we've been fluoridating the water for 50 years, and they're absolutely right. And today, one in every 6 American children has a neurodevelopmental abnormality, a behavioral disorder. The incidence of cancer and heart disease is rising, and we have some of the highest rates of heart disease and cancer in the world. Why is that? Well, I think you'll be fascinated if you read the book, The Fluoride Deception. And then, of course, we have another book. It's called Evidence of Harm. It's a story of the autism epidemic. And both Fluoride Deception and Evidence of Harm are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. We've got a great new 4-tape set on autism and the causes of autism. We have a great new 4-tape set on depleted uranium and what they're doing to our boys over in the Gulf. We have a great 4-tape set on Vaccine A. It's the story of the experimental vaccine was given to all of the men in the first Gulf War with disastrous results. That's Vaccine A. We've got a 4-tape set on the Gulf War syndrome. We've got a 4-tape set on the anthrax vaccine. All of this is available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We want you to get the information. We want you to help us disseminate the information. Because if you're not involved, who will be, and if not now, when? Next time it could be your son or your daughter who's going to be drafted to go overseas as cannon fodder for the Third World War, and they're going to be used as guinea pigs like the boys were during the First Gulf War, where almost half of them have permanent injury. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up for the second hour here of Radio Liberty.
Auditorium right here.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. And our guest this evening is Daniel Sheehan. And, of course, Daniel, do you have a website or anything you'd like to get out for our listeners?
Sure. The people can contact us at our website, which is at www.newparadigminstitute.com. That's Paradigm is P-A-R-A-I-D-I-G-M, Paradigm, New Paradigm Institute, .org, and they can reach us there. And that we have a lot of information there about what we've been doing. That over the years, as you pointed out, that because of my encounter with one case after another as a professional trial lawyer of uncovering these rather extraordinary hidden secrets about America, we had finally come to the realization that the normal channels that we're taught about during our high school civics courses and even in college are supposed to be the remedies for these things do not function, that neither the Republican nor Democratic Party function honestly and in accordance with the interests of the people of our country. The major news media, the networks, and the major newspapers don't function honestly and in accordance with the principles that we've been taught. So what we talk about at the New Paradigm Institute is the need to take a much more fundamental approach about this and engage in a major public education campaign and an organizing campaign around the country to bring about a more fundamental realignment of our principles in keeping with the traditions that we were actually taught. And so you'll find out about us at the newparadigminstitute.org. And we can share our views with you, and you can contact us, and we can get back in touch with you.
All right. Well, how are we ever going to be able to reach the people, the great masses, the people who are addicted to television, who listen to the major networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, listen to the major talk show hosts, and of course, they play a little game. One group tends to be conservative, the other group tends to be liberal, but they both give the establishment line, just slightly different versions of that. So how, Daniel, you are on the front lines of this battle, and certainly you've dedicated your life to it, as I have.
Yeah.
But how do we reach the people?
Well, in my particular opinion is that we need a four-fold program. That's why we have a New Paradigm Institute. We're setting up a New Paradigm Academy, and then we'll have a New Paradigm Project, and we'll have a New Paradigm Public Policy Center eventually in Washington. And what I believe we need to do is we need to start with the New Paradigm Institute, which actually does an analysis of these alternative worldviews to really try to understand, for example, what the difference between a true liberal is and a true conservative, and what the difference is between, for example, a conservative and a real reactionary, one of these so-called neocons. Now, what is that? People throw the word around, but they don't know exactly what it means. And how does that relate to a classic old-time kind of authoritarian who believes in kind of a Caesar or some kind of an emperor or a tyrant of some sort? That people don't really understand this. And so what we do at the New Paradigm Institute is to elucidate what the real specific fundamental underlying beliefs are that distinguish one of these worldviews from another. Now, these have their profound implications that people don't seem to think about, but these are questions like the cosmology or the creation story of how our whole physical universe even came into being. They're fundamentally different views about this, from the Big Bang theory to the emanationist theory that the entire universe was enfolded into being by an infinite and eternal consciousness, which is our theistic point of view, and others. But this is what we do at the New Paradigm Institute, is to try to explain what these worldviews are and what the full implications are from a point of view of public policy and principle. So that's what we do there. And what we're going to be doing is establishing a New Paradigm Academy where young people can come before they go off to college and get sort of brainwashed from one college or another, that there's only one basic worldview and it's the way they look at things, but to see what all of these different worldviews look like so they're prepared.
All right, you hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Daniel Sheehan. We'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Daniel Sheehan, and for the New Paradigm Institute, and a fascinating individual, certainly dedicating his life to try to do something to make the American people understand that most of what we have learned about the history of our society over this last 50 years really isn't true. Now, we told certain things about in our classroom about how the system works, but that's not really how it works. Have you run into a problem as an attorney where sometimes you feel that the judges are not impartial as they're supposed to be, or that this idea of selecting an impartially selected judges, many times the system is designed to get a judge in there who will rig the trial?
Oh, it's totally clear. For example, in the Iran-Contra case, when we found out about the, you know, the criminal drug smuggling that was going on coming out of Latin America, the cocaine smuggling that was going on.
You mean the CIA involved?
Yeah, that's right, exactly. Right. There was major cocaine smuggling coming into the United States, and they were using the funds to buy weapons that were being smuggled to the Contras and to other kind of terrorist groups down in Latin America. We were astonished, and we came to the Congress, and I met with members of both parties. I met with Tip O'Neill in the House, and then I went over and I met with the Senator Warren Rudman from the Republican Party on the Senate side, and I met with the staff of Richard Lugar, and I talked with all of these people trying to get them to do something about it, and they wouldn't. So we ended up putting together a major federal lawsuit and filing it down in the Southern District of Florida in Miami. So I go in and we file the lawsuit. And the chief federal judge in Miami, James Lawrence King, ended up taking the case himself, didn't allow it to go through the normal procedures of putting the case into a basket and rolling the balls and picking out a judge. He took it himself as the chief federal judge and sat on it. We filed the case just before 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon in May of 1986. He actually took the case, and he called me at 10 o'clock in the morning on Monday morning following that Friday and ordered me to be in the federal court in Miami from my office in Washington, D.C. by 2 o'clock that afternoon, or he was going to summarily throw the case out. We filed the Iran-Contra case, and I show up there at about 10 minutes to 2. I come sliding into the courtroom, and there he is sitting on the bench, and he has arrayed out in front of him already a dozen lawyers who had already been retained to serve as the legal counsel for the people we had sued. We named all these people, Richard Secord and Albert Hakim and, Jack Singlaub and all of these people, the famous people that were involved.
Hold that thought. All right, this is Dr. Stan. My guest this evening is Daniel Sheehan. And Daniel actually was the lawyer who filed the case in the Iran-Contra, a case involving, of course, the illicit smuggling of drugs from South America into the United States so the CIA could buy drugs. And they were working, of course, with the Contras, and they were buying drugs. All of this was illegal. They were trading weapons to the Iranians somehow or other, rather intricately to the Israelis. It was all dishonest. And so when Daniels actually filed a lawsuit representing people who were very concerned, who wanted to do something to stop the government CIA from bringing drugs into this country, which was destroying the black community and the Hispanic community and the lives of so many people, and to expose the involvement of General Secord and other people working with special forces and with sort of a secret government that we have. Why? You tell the story
what happens then is that the chief federal judge in Miami, James Lawrence King, ordered me into the courtroom, and he immediately put under seal, secret seal, the existence of this lawsuit. And he introduced me to the lawyers that were there, and it turns out that the chief counsel for Adolfo Calero, who was one of the main Contra leaders that we sued, the lawyer that was going to be representing Adolfo Calero turned out to be the former chief legal counsel for the American Central Intelligence Agency.
Well, isn't that a coincidence?
Under Bush, under Bush Sr. And it turned out that the lawyer for Ronald Joseph Martin, the head of the Tamiami gun shop that was giving the false end user certificates for all the illegal weapons they were smuggling, he was going to be represented by the former chief of the criminal division of the Justice Department in Miami, who had been the head of the criminal division as of Friday afternoon when I filed the lawsuit. But by Monday morning, he had retired and become the lawyer for the chief Contra. And the judge, it turns out, James Lawrence King, was a former secret counsel for the Central Legal Counsel for the Central Intelligence Agency.
Did you have a feeling that this whole court case was fixed ahead of time?
Well, they tried to. They tried to do it as hard as they could. And what we did is, and he threatened to have me held in immediate criminal contempt of court. Judge Lawrence King, he said so right from the bench. He said, I will have you held in direct immediate criminal contempt of court and put in federal prison for 6 months if you tell a soul about the existence of this lawsuit, or you try to tell anybody about the content of the lawsuit, and if you try to tell anybody about any of the information that you gather, as a private citizen, as a lawyer, you try to tell anybody about the evidence you gathered about this, I'll put you in prison. And so I was kind of, I told him I completely disagreed with that, and, you know, that was outrageous. There was no way he could do that legally. And I ended up, he said, but I just want to make certain that you've been notified on the record that we'll do this to you. Well, it turns out, this guy, James Lawrence King, used to serve on the board of directors of Meyer Lansky's National Bank of Miami. Meyer Lansky is a huge mafia don, or assistant don, and they're a mafia bank. And what they did, they were the bank in which the American mafia were putting the skim of cash they were taking off the casinos in Las Vegas into the bank to secretly fund the covert operations to try to overthrow the Castro government with the CIA.
Well, because I think that for our listeners, they must understand that the mafia and the CIA have worked together very closely for many years.
Since the very beginning.
Right.
From 1947. You know, you remember that Lucky Luciano, there were secret meetings that took place between Lucky Luciano, a major mafia don, and Tom Dewey. In 1944, up at Comstock Prison, the Great Meadows Prison up in northern New York, up in Lake George. And they had the secret meetings, and Lucky Luciano was allowed out of jail to escape, or to be let free. Didn't escape, they let him go, and he went back and he agreed to handle all the heroin from the Southeast Asian Golden Triangle, to process that opium into heroin, and to move it through Cuba under Batista, to move the heroin through there into the United States. And when Castro overthrew Cuba, the Cuban government of Batista in January of 1959, one of the major reasons why the mafia participated in planning to assassinate Castro was because he had totally messed up their heroin supply line into the United States. And the reason that the Central Intelligence Agency, the chief of security of the Central Intelligence Agency, Sheffield Edwards, participated in authorizing the assassination team to be put together in July of 1960 to kill Castro is because that was the major secret source of funding, that heroin supply, for the Kuomintang, the so-called nationalist Chinese over there in Asia that were opposing the Chinese government. So all of this history is something that this is what I'll be talking about, in fact, when I appear at the conspiracy conference next weekend.
Now, how are you possibly going to cover this in an hour?
Well, it's actually I did 13 3-hour seminars on this when I taught at the University of California in Santa Barbara. That are all there, that they're in, you know, 3-hour seminars on, you know, broadcast quality videotape that we have when I taught these courses. And so that I've become considered one of the major experts in the United States about this from a strictly academic, scholastic point of view, because I've used the talent that the training that I had gotten at Harvard College about how to understand cases, how to be a good lawyer, how to do the research, and I've put it together and have taught it at a college level.
Yeah, I'm surprised you haven't ended up like Gary Webb, who of course you've written about.
Yeah.
The drug smuggling from South America and the CIA's involvement in that, and he recently committed suicide, by shooting himself in the head Twice.
I know.
I mean, you know, if anybody honestly believes that story, they have to be incredibly naive. This is what happens to people who get too far out of line. And I'm surprised, Daniel, because I've followed your career for many years.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, they tried, as you know, James Lawrence King, the federal judge down there, you know, when I confronted him and insisted upon keeping on presenting the evidence, and when I agreed to testify in front of the United States Congress in March of in November of 1985, I appeared and testified in front of Mike Barnes, the subcommittee on Western Hemisphere Affairs of the House Foreign Relations Committee, and Henry Hyde, who now chairs the committee in the House of Representatives and is getting ready to retire, but at that time he jumped up and started ranting and made them turn off all the C-SPAN cameras because I was telling them about this off-the-shelf criminal racketeering enterprise that was functioning and smuggling opium and smuggling heroin and smuggling drugs into the United States and using the money to purchase weapons and smuggling them illegally to these right-wing terrorist operations in Central America. And they shut off all the C-SPAN cameras and wouldn't allow it to go out to the public. And then James Lawrence King, the federal judge, tried to have me held in criminal contempt of court for actually responding to a request of the United States Congress to testify about this.
And so what happened?
I confronted him and had this huge showdown with him and threatened to go public with in every way that I possibly could. And what he ended up doing is he ended up throwing the case out and saying if we attempted to appeal his ruling, that he would enter what they call a Rule 11 against me, saying that I had filed a lawsuit when I should have known that I was never going to be able to win the lawsuit, that I had been doing it solely and exclusively for political purposes. And if I tried to appeal it, he would impose this $1 million fine upon me personally. And then he wrote this big long opinion saying that I was clearly lying about everything that I had said in the whole case because nobody was ever ultimately criminally convicted for it. And of course that was because George Bush had became president and he entered pardons of all these guys after they were indicted. They were indicted in front of the court of Gerhard Gesell up in Washington D.C., the federal judge, by the special prosecutor Lawrence Walsh. And when George Bush pardoned them all, Judge James Lawrence King immediately entered an order declaring that therefore I must have filed our case solely for political purposes and imposed $1 million fine against me.
So what happened?
Well, we ended up having to pay it.
Yeah. Where did you get the $1 million?
Well, we sold all of our offices and everything in Washington D.C. The entire Christic Institute. We had 5 offices. We employed over 50 people. We had done the Karen Silkwood case. We'd done the Three Mile Island case. We'd prosecuted under the Federal Civil Rights Act the Ku Klux Klan and the American Nazi Party. We'd done all these big cases, but because the entire establishment closed in against us with Judge King leading the way, the former CIA covert lawyer who is now the chief judge in Miami. This is in response to your question of, you know, are there judges that are actually so biased they won't do anything fairly? He's one of them. And what they did is they imposed this order against us, never gave us one single minute of a hearing to try to defend ourselves, to say, look, this is ridiculous. It's perfectly clear that what we said is true. Everybody knows it's true, what we said. And yet you've imposed $1 million judgment against us without a single minute of hearing, without any way to respond to this. And then they go around trying to tell everybody that we clearly must have been lying about this because nobody was ultimately criminally convicted, and that was solely because George Bush pardoned them all.
Well, now, what about the opportunity to appeal this? Did you try to appeal? They wouldn't allow you to appeal.
We filed an appeal to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, and it was a 3-judge panel that was appointed, and we were preparing the legal briefs to put in front of them, and Judge King refused to send the record of the case up to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals over and over again. And we had a major 2-volume affidavit from Edwin Wilson telling all about the details of this, whom they've just had to let out of jail, as you remember, because it was proved that the CIA was lying about him. And we had a big 2-volume affidavit which showed that we were telling the truth. And when we filed it in the Court of Appeals, the chief judge on the panel was killed with a letter bomb. He was murdered. And they killed the judge that was going to be on our 3-judge panel. And then George Bush Sr. appointed a new judge to take his place.
Well, we'll be back in just a moment. It sounds like you almost think there's a conspiracy out there. We'll be right back with Daniel Sheehan. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and really it's a fascinating story. And the thing is that I've followed so much of this, a lot of the details I've never heard of, but I remember the Christic Institute suit, and of course I have all the things that tell me how bad the Christic Institute was. We've got books on the Christic Institute. But, you know, there is a great deal of truth in everything that is being said here. And, of course, everybody is trying to say, oh, well, it's because they were communists. This is why they were doing what they were doing. Is it possible that it wasn't because they were communists, because they were just people, American citizens, who were concerned about the fact that we're losing our freedom because we have lost the integrity of our court system? Well, anyway, you said that chief justice, or one of the three judges on the panel, was killed with a letter bomb.
Right.
George Bush appointed another judge, what happened?
When Judge Vance was killed with a letter bomb, they postponed the hearing that we were supposed to have in front of that three-judge panel, in front of which we would have won that one. But when Judge Vance was killed, George Bush appointed this guy Stanley Birch Jr. to become the new head of that three-judge panel. Stanley Birch Jr. had never been a judge a day in his life. He, in fact, was a huge contributor to the Bush campaign and was the lawyer, the patent lawyer, for the Cabbage Patch doll. And he was taken and put on the three-judge panel in place of Judge Vance, and just went wild when we came into the courtroom to try to do our appeal, ranting about how we never should have filed this lawsuit. We should have known they were never going to be allowed to do this. We were attempting to usurp the authority of the Justice Department, because for whatever reason the Justice Department had decided not to prosecute Richard Secord and Albert Hakim and Jack Singlaub and all these guys who clearly were in gross violation of about 10 different federal criminal laws. Whatever their reason was for exercising their prosecutorial discretion in the negative, we, in fact, were completely out of line as private citizens for filing a lawsuit attempting to show the world what was going on. And that he said because of that, he was going to sustain Judge King's ruling against us and make us pay the $1 million. And
now, what about the other two judges?
Well, one of the other judges was a Richard Nixon appointee. You know, and one of the things that we had done in this entire lawsuit is we had pointed out, and this is what was so critical about it, we had pointed out that, look, this lawsuit, under the federal civil racketeering law, there's a provision that if you can show that the criminal actions that were engaged in, that you're filing a lawsuit against as a private citizen, were part of a much longer-range scheme of criminal racketeering, you were allowed to put in evidence showing what that entire scheme was and how long it had been going on. And we in fact put in the pleadings showing that the whole Iran-Contra crisis, the whole drug smuggling operation and stuff that were going on to support the Contras, dated all the way back into Southeast Asia with the heroin smuggling that was going on by the Central Intelligence Agency, and the all the way back into supporting the heroin smuggling to support the Kuomintang. We put all of this information in showing that both Republican and Democratic administrations had been supporting this criminal covert program, this conspiracy, for all this time. And it made everybody in the Republican and Democratic Party go crazy.
No, they were all mad at you.
They were all
mad. Didn't have any friends at
all. Well, because we hadn't filed it to make friends. What we had done is said, look, this is what the evidence shows, and that we're perfectly prepared to come into a court of law and to put court-admissible evidence in before a jury, and we'll prove to you that this is what happened. In the same way that we proved what happened in the Pentagon Papers case, in the same way that we proved what happened in the Karen Silkwood case.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guests this evening, Daniel Sheehan, of course, who is the lawyer for the Christic Institute. They had filed a suit. They actually were trying to appeal the $1 million judgment against them. They probably would have won the court's case, only the chief judge was killed by a letter bomb. Isn't that coincidence? And then, of course, the new man who was appointed by George Herbert Walker Bush to replace him. Remember, George Herbert Walker Bush had been the director of the CIA, deeply involved in drug smuggling. So he puts in a man who's never been a judge, who, of course, will not allow them to present any evidence at all. And one of the other judges on the three-man panel was a Nixon appointee. And, of course, Nixon has been named, as well as people in both political parties involved in drug smuggling. So, anyway, this three-man panel would not hear your suit. Were you able to appeal it beyond that?
Well, sure. We appealed it to the United States Supreme Court, and by that time, the seven of the nine judges on the United States Supreme Court had all been appointed by Ronald Reagan or Richard Nixon or George Bush. And so they simply gave us a one-liner and saying, no, we're just not going to review it as a matter of discretion. And so we had to sell. We had to sell our offices in Washington, D.C., our offices in North Carolina, our offices up in Portland, Oregon, and our office in Los Angeles in order to pay it. And we paid the entire $1.2 million cost. They made us pay all the costs for the entire other side as though we'd accused some poor innocent people of something that was perfectly clearly not true. But everybody knew what we had said was true, but they made us pay it. And then within 2 weeks after we got through paying it, George Bush ordered his appointee as the head of the Internal Revenue Service to revoke the 501c3 tax-exempt charter for the Christic Institute, saying that we had been engaged in political activity because of our having filed the lawsuit. Since no one was ultimately convicted of it, we had to have filed it solely for political purposes, and then yanked our 501c3 tax-exempt charter so that we couldn't do any more lawsuits.
Well, yeah. That was a good way to silence you.
Yeah,
wasn't
and that was all. That was James Lawrence King. All people have to do is look into who James Lawrence King is, and this is, in a sense, a long answer to your short question of, have we ever had an experience where the judges that have been appointed, you know, were so clearly biased and put into the position for the purpose of shutting off any kind of a fair trial, because his whole point was being down in Miami to be the chief federal judge to protect the Central Intelligence Agency, because Miami is the largest base for the entire Central Intelligence Agency anywhere in the world outside of Langley.
And I think what's really so tragic, and most people don't understand, that when the court system becomes corrupt, when you have judges who will not enforce the law, but are there for political purposes and to cover for a government misconduct, then no man's life or property really safe.
That's absolutely right, including all of our property. You know, they basically ended up taking all of the property that had been put together by the Christic Institute over a 12-year period to try to be a public justice organ so that we could do cases when the Justice Department and other people refused to do what was required, and they just weren't going to allow a thing like that to stand. And but we had thought that we weren't playing favorites of the Republican or Democratic Party, and that's why people said, look, you should have just done whatever the Democrats wanted to do and just confined yourself to just accusing just that one administration of Reagan and Bush of, you know, engaging in a single instance of, you know, smuggling drugs and selling arms to a criminal operation, and you would have been able to do it. So why didn't you just confine yourself to that? And what we said is, because that wouldn't have solved the problem. It would have just happened again. If you pretend that the problem is much more, if you put a bandage on something and it's really a cancerous tumor, it doesn't do any good to put a bandage on it. And so that what we did is said, we're going to get to the bottom of this, and we were coming to the end of the Cold War, and we said, look, this gives a great opportunity to expose the entire history of the criminal covert operations of the Central Intelligence Agency dating all the way back to 1947, and show that they've been consistently involved in this type of a criminal pattern.
And you're talking about specifically in smuggling drugs. And,
yes.
And in murder and
that's
assassination,
right.
and all of those.
That's
good
exactly
things.
The big conspiracy, the big one, you know. And so we laid it right straight on them. And the man who wrote, was the author of the Federal Criminal Racketeering Act, G. Robert Blakey, filed an amicus brief saying, this is the most important and most professionally filed racketeering, influenced, and corrupt organization act lawsuit that he has ever seen in his life. And Judge James Lawrence King refused to allow the amicus brief of the law professor from Cornell University to be put in the record.
Well, So much for justice and judicial impartiality. Now, I think there are some honest judges out there.
Oh, sure there are.
But, of course, sometimes it's very hard to get them.
Yeah.
Because this idea, and I know this to be true, this idea of they're going to have the blind drawing to see who the judge is. Well, if you believe in that, you probably still believe in the tooth fairy. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is Daniel Sheehan. Yeah. Of course, we've been talking about, of course, the demise of the Christic Institute. And of course, there are many, many people who accuse the Christic Institute of being simply a communist front organization.
Yeah,
how would you respond to that?
Well,
sorry.
You know where that came from? It was Jack Singlaub. Jack Singlaub, who was the United States Army Major General, who was he was the commander of the South Korean American military forces when President Carter came to power. And when President Carter came to office in 1977, in January of 1977, he decided to cut back some of the military troops in South Korea, the U.S. military troops. And Jack Singlaub went on the warpath about that and started speaking out publicly against the president. And it was sort of like a big thing, like the confrontation between MacArthur and Truman. And so the fact is that President Carter dismissed him as the commanding general of the Allied forces in South Korea. And Jack Singlaub retired, and he became the international president of the World Anti-Communist League. And the World Anti-Communist League is just filled with former fascists from World War II and Nazis, World War II war criminals. You can look at there's a book called Inside the League by Scott Anderson. You can see that book, and you just find that book and look, and you'll see the whole documented history of who the World Anti-Communist League is. And it was Jack Singlaub, because Jack Singlaub had become involved in facilitating and participating in the weapons supply operations to the Contras under the Reagan-Bush administration.
Well, don't you think that this was really a front for the CIA?
Well, it's a back channel in a certain way. But the fact of the matter is, you're not. If we had sued the CIA directly in its own official capacity, they would have dismissed the case, saying it was a political question. And the question of what the CIA was doing or not is a political question. So what we did is, since they had taken the position that, oh, the CIA is not involved in this, the administration is not involved in this, there may be some private individuals, some people who are retired military officers or retired CIA people might be involved in this in their purely private capacity. So we said, okay, fine, we'll sue them in their private capacity.
Well, now, did you include Poindexter or Oliver North?
Well, no, we did not. We named them as uncharged co-conspirators. Because if we had named them, then immediately the sovereign immunity that applies to government agencies would have applied to everybody. So what we did is we named all of these 26 men in their private capacity, and Jack Singlaub was one of them. And so Jack Singlaub cranked up the entire World Anti-Communist League and had them start, the people who published those books were the World Anti-Communist League.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Daniel Sheehan. And, of course, my contention is that communism has been financed since its very inception by people here in this country of the best enemy money could buy, and whatever you worse want to label somebody or discredit them, why you accuse them of being a communist. And, of course, some of them are communists, but very often, of course, this is simply a means of demonizing people, and especially liberal people who are trying to point out what's really going on behind the scenes. Would that be a fairly fair statement?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, look, in this case, you know, here I was. You know, I was the first Sheehan man ever to even get to go to college. My dad is a prison guard. You know, my mom is a waitress. You know, I get the biggest scholarship ever given to an American to go to Harvard College. I'm lucky enough to go there, and I go to the law school. I'm working at the biggest law firm in the country, working for the New York Times as one of their main lawyers. You know, I've never even been out of the country, except one. I went one time, to do the Rhodes Scholarship thing, to go do some interviews and go over to England and came back. And other than that, I've never been out of the country. I couldn't order a glass of water in Spanish. And Jack Singlaub is saying that I'm a secret agent for the Cuban secret police and the DGI. I didn't know who they were.
Well, couldn't you have sued him for libel?
Well, but who cares about that? You know, I mean, they could call you anything. If you're in this kind of a professional business, people will say all kinds of things about you. But, you know, for them to publish this book, that book that they got, you remember, it was called The Christic Institute, Legal Terrorism, right? And that's probably the one you're talking about. And that particular book shows exactly what their plan was to start calling everybody terrorists now. And so they were calling us, like calling me a communist. It's ridiculous. I was the legal counsel for the United States Jesuit headquarters, the biggest order of the Catholic Church. It's one of the most, the Catholic Church is one of the most virulently anti-communist organizations around. And to, you know, and to have nothing better to say about me than, oh, they're a bunch of communists, is ridiculous on the face of it. It was just as ridiculous as them saying that there was no evidence to show that these guys were supplying weapons to the Contras. And so I just kept right on going. And then what they ended up doing is taking away all of our buildings, all of our property to make us pay for, you know, this $1 million fine that he just imposed on us. It wasn't a judgment, it was a fine. We never got to defend ourselves, never got to have any hearings, never got to put any proof in it on the issue at all. And so I think people should, for example, people should check out and look at what the case of Edwin Wilson is, who's just been ordered to be released from federal prison. He's the guy, as I mentioned, that we had. I was the only person who ever did a full-scale deposition interview of him. And we have a two-volume sworn statement from him outlining all the details of the stuff that showed that what we were saying was true in the case. And Judge James Lawrence King kept constantly trying to hide that record, wouldn't allow it to be sent up to the Court of Appeals, kept sending it back to us. And now, just years later, all of a sudden, there's this big brouhaha because he has to be let out of prison because it was clear they were lying about it.
Well, now, of course, did you represent Wilson there? Who actually?
No. I just ended up being contacted by him when he heard about this big me testifying in front of the United States Congress.
Well, do you think that's why that they set him up to be sent to prison? Because he had dared to support you? Because obviously CIA was out to get him.
No, he was in prison already.
Oh, he was?
Yeah, okay. He was in prison. And what he did is when I testified in front of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, he heard about it and said, I know what this guy's talking about. I know who he's talking about. You know, and he contacted us, and we were able to put the information into the record. And that's when Ross Perot came to see me. I mean, Ross Perot came to see me. Here I am flying around in Ross Perot's Learjet briefing him on what this is. It was Ross Perot who brought all of this information to the head of the FBI. He brought to William Webster. He's the one that brought our evidence and information to Webster. And Bill Webster is the one who started the criminal investigation against Richard Secord and Albert Hakim and all these guys. And nobody in the world knows that. And that is the reason why Ross Perot ran against George Herbert Walker Bush in 1992, because he knew that Bush was lying, he knew that he was involved in all the Contra stuff, and he was outraged at the fact that he was involved, not only in the smuggling of the cocaine from Latin America, but had been involved in the smuggling of the heroin from Southeast Asia. And Ross Perot, as you remember, was on the National Security Advisory Committee for Ronald Reagan, because he was adamant to trying to find out what happened to the prisoners of war in Vietnam. Why is it that so many of the men were left behind in there? And that was because some of them had been involved in trying to conceal the opium smuggling and stuff that was going on there, and had been left behind. There's that book that has been written about this called Kiss the Boys Goodbye.
Yes, the Monica Jensen.
Exactly. And that's the answer to it. And so that's why Ross Perot contacted me, and that's why we gave the information to him. He's the one that gave it to Bill Webster at the FBI. They're the ones that began the major criminal investigation of this. And that is why Edwin Meese came all of a sudden on television there in Thanksgiving of 1985 and said, holy mackerel, what do you know? We just discovered that there's this horrible problem of this young colonel got out of control and basically has been doing all these things without authorization and tried to make North have to take the rap for this whole thing. And rap, he wouldn't do it, but what happened is the Attorney General, Edwin Meese, took it upon himself to ask for the appointment of a special prosecutor to come in so he could stop the FBI investigation that was being conducted by Bill Webster. And he, therefore, Meese, could draft his own charter for the special prosecutor, which confined the question to be investigated just to whether or not President Reagan knew about and had signed a written authorization authorizing the transfer of some of the profits generated by the sale of TOW missiles to the Iranians to be transferred to the Contras. And unless it could be proven, you know, that he had done that, there was nothing to look into.
But, of course, they would not have told Ronald Reagan what they were doing. And I think I remembered Poindexter, Admiral Poindexter, saying the president would have loved to have known what we were doing, but we weren't going to tell him because he had to have plausible deniability.
That's right. In fact, you remember that interesting confrontation that went on between Inouye, when Inouye said to him, well, you know, here's a statement right here that the president has issued saying that he, in fact, had never been informed about it. And Poindexter said, see, that's just the way we planned it.
And the rest of, when and, people tell me that George Bush, you know, planned the attack on the World Trade Center, I said, that's ridiculous. They would never tell the president what they were going to do. I mean, they would certainly keep the information from him, because, of course, it could never be proven that he had ordered the attack on the World Trade Center. They'd bring down the government. He's got to be able to say, I didn't know, and that is actually true. Plausible denial. He may very well knew something was going to happen, but he didn't know what it was, any more than Ronald Reagan, I think, knew exactly what Poindexter and North were doing. Would you agree with that?
Well, what we know, see, I mean, the advantage that I have, Stan, is that having been the professional attorney, trial lawyer, who has been the chief counsel in these particular cases, I know absolutely with full detail exactly what the facts are in each of those cases. So I can speak to those cases, and I can speak to the fact that it was absolutely clear that George Bush, as the vice president for Ronald Reagan, was in fact directing the entire Iran-Contra operation.
Well, I mean, but not the president wasn't, but vice president was. In fact, and I very really think that Cheney is probably the man who's really making things happen in the Bush administration.
Yeah, well, that's perfectly evident. I mean, what we're looking at is basically a replay of the exact same thing. That you had George Herbert Walker Bush, the former head of the Central Intelligence Agency, sitting in at the right-hand shoulder of Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan was a nice enough fella and a hearty, well-met fella, and was good at appearing at functions, but really didn't know anything about what was going on. And George Bush is the guy that was running everything. His national security advisor, the vice presidential national security advisor, Donald P. Gregg, was meeting regularly with the people that were running the weapons directly into the Contras. And that I have the talking papers from his office on this. I've put them into the court record showing that he was meeting directly with the Felix Rodriguez, who was in fact running the Ilopango airlift to the military equipment to the Contras. And so we know that to be an absolute fact. We know that when Sawyer and Cooper were shot down in October of 1986 over Nicaragua in the famous C-123 that Hassenfuss was in, turns out that Cooper had in his wallet when they found his body, he had the private unlisted home telephone number for Donald P. Gregg, who was the national security advisor for Vice President George Bush, in his wallet. You know, these are just facts that we know to be absolutely true, and that the Christic Institute stood in the face of these people, both administrations, attempting to say that, look, we're approaching the end of this Cold War. We have an opportunity here to expose the full history of the Central Intelligence Agency, to show how it is that if you give some national security state bureaucracy the kind of authoritarian power under the rationale of having to fight some ultimate other, in this case, the quote, the communists. If you give them that kind of absolute power, they will be corrupted. And they will, in fact, do just exactly what you fear they're going to do. They end up challenging the civil authority of the government, and which they did. They were responsible for ousting from office Senator Frank Church from Idaho. They were responsible for ousting from office Senator Dick Clark of Iowa. They were responsible for ousting from office Birch Bayh from Indiana. These people went after Senator Cranston. That these people organized themselves politically to attack these people. And this is exactly what we were telling people they did. They're the ones that were responsible for getting rid of Senator Durenberger. You know, and that's how Paul Wellstone ended up getting into office, because they attacked Durenberger, because Durenberger was the first one to stand up on the floor of the Senate and demand a full-scale official investigation of Richard C. Gordon, Albert Hakim, and Oliver North, and these others. And they basically turned on him and attacked him and got him thrown out of office. This is the, and we said, look, we're coming to the end of the Cold War. Why don't we take a look at this and do our own Glasnost? Why don't we look at this and do and expose this? Shut down the Central Intelligence Agency. You know, put the legitimate intelligence gathering, military intelligence gathering activities inside the legitimate branches of offices that need to do this, and not allow this kind of political intelligence office to run any longer. And we put this up in front of both parties. And I went to see Senator Claiborne Pell, who was the ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and asked him to put together a special select committee to look into all of this stuff, and to please put in charge of this John Kerry from Massachusetts, because he was a young, aggressive, tough guy, and he would do this thing. And so they did. They put Kerry in charge of the Senate Select Committee on Terrorism and Narcotics. And we gave all of this information to Kerry. We handed to him hand over fist, you know, document after document. We had shipping invoices of the weapons that were being shipped out of the Fort Lauderdale Hollywood Airport down to Ilopango and then shipped into the Contras. We had the details of the landing strips. We knew the secret code words for the landing. We knew where they were bringing the heroin or the cocaine in. We knew where they were selling it from. We had copies of the private unlisted telephone numbers that you called to get the drugs. And I sat right in the office of the head of the special task force of the DEA and pushed the memo across the desk to him sitting there. The guy who brought me in there was the former chief of security for the U.S. military mission in Tehran, one of our investigators. I gave it to the guy, and he looked at it, and his eyes got really big, and he pushed it back across the table, and he said, "Look, Dan, you know what this is, and so do I." He said, "I intend to live to see my retirement, and I advise you do the same."
Now, who was this you were talking to?
This was the head of the special task force of the Drug Enforcement Administration.
Let me ask you a question. I have heard that there was a contract put out on Ross Perot in 1992, and
Exactly. No, I know exactly what it is that happened.
When at least Ross Perot said that he was running against George Bush.
Yes.
Something to the effect that they were out to kill his family and kill him or something of the sort. What was the truth?
What they did, Stan. Is they doctored together some pictures of his daughter, and they had some pictures of his daughter. I know exactly what the pictures were. Ross probably wouldn't want me to tell you what they were, but that they were faked pictures of his daughter, and his daughter was just in the process of getting ready to be married, and they said that if he didn't withdraw from the election, they were going to publish in one of these scandal rags these photographs of his daughter.
Now, was this, 1992?
This was 1992, when he was running against Bush.
Right.
And that's why he withdrew. Remember, he withdrew and then came back in? He thought better of it and came back in? That's what he did. And he also contacted the FBI, and it turns out, very interestingly, he contacted the FBI in Dallas and told them about a plan to bug the telephones in his office, which a fellow by the name of Scott Barnes had brought to him. He showed him the blueprints of his office and where the phones were, and that he had been hired by the Republican Party to come in and bug Ross's telephone. Ross called the FBI, like a straight, red-blooded American that he is, and it turns out the new SAC, the special agent in charge of the FBI in Dallas, had just become Buck Revell. Buck Revell, you know who Buck Revell is. Buck Revell had been just thrown out of Washington, D.C. because of his close association with Oliver North and doing the entire anti-terror stuff and the drug smuggling stuff. So he had been, as punishment, had been banished from Washington, and he ended up being in the Dallas office. And so that when Ross Perot places the phone call, he ends up getting put into Buck Revell. And so Buck Revell, when he gets this telephone call, he excoriates Ross and starts contacting the New York Times and telling him that Ross Perot is a paranoid delusional, and he's got all these kind of paranoid beliefs that he's being wiretapped. Whereas, in fact, we knew perfectly well that Scott Barnes had given him all the information about the wiretapping, And so the two things came together, that the wiretapping conspiracy thing by Scott Barnes, and, you know, Howard Rosenberg knows all about this, the chief researcher for Dan Rather over at CBS. He knows all about this. And then the thing of the faked pictures, the scandalous pictures of Ross's daughter that were faked, that they were going to destroy her right on the eve of her wedding, those were the two things that they did to him. And he just threw his hands up and said, this is not worth it. You know, but he had effectively done the damage, and he took 19% of the popular vote, and it came right out of the hide of George Herbert Walker Bush.
Well, because I remember how Rush Limbaugh ridiculed Ross Perot.
Exactly right.
Belittled him and demonized him and how ridiculous, right. You know, he's just sort of paranoid. He thinks they're out to get him.
Yeah. Limbaugh is just a big, fat, you know, mouthpiece for the right-wing kind of fascist group that tried to keep Ross out of there.
Well, I always like to refer to Rush Limbaugh as the finest conservative commentator that money can buy. We're going to be right back in just a minute to wrap up the program. A fascinating hour, really an hour and a half with Daniel Sheehan. So we'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we're just going to have to give Daniel about 3 minutes to wrap up the program, then we'll let him go. It's getting late. So we've got 3 minutes. What message would you like to leave with our listeners out across America?
Well, I would say this, Dan, is that I'd like to have people contact us, as I said, at our website at www.newparadigminstitute.org. To find out that I don't want people to despair over this. That people always say to me, Lee, gee, you know more about these criminal conspiracies than anybody else alive I've ever talked to. You must be really despairing of any being able to do anything. Absolutely not. You know, the fact of the matter is that this information is disillusioning if you still adhere to the kind of fictionalized, kind of naive beliefs about our country. But the fact is, to be disillusioned is not bad. Unless, of course, you wish to continue to be illusioned. But to be disillusioned gives you the first opportunity to try to figure out what the strategic steps are that you need to take to bring our country back, to save our country, to get it back onto the track where we were before these people all came to power with the National Security Act of 1947. This is what the problem is that we face. It's a fundamental, generic problem that began at that time, and that it continues to manifest itself now in the form of this radical, quote, anti-terrorism campaign that they're all on. And don't despair. Contact the New Paradigm Institute. There are many things that you can do to take concrete, specific steps to bring our country back to where we've all been taught and believe that it belongs. So stick with Dr. Stan. Learn the information. Contact the New Paradigm Institute at www.newparadigminstitute.org, and we can all work together all across the political spectrum. Everyone doesn't have to agree on every single thing, but understand that just because people don't agree with you doesn't make them a communist, doesn't make them a fascist. It just makes them another American that we all need to gather together now in this time of crisis, not to save ourselves from exterior terrorists, but to save ourselves from those people that we've always been warned would come to power if we were not eternally vigilant.
Well, I hope that we can get you back on our program from time to time, Daniel, to keep us abreast of what's going on. I think it's been a fascinating period of time, and I'm really looking forward to meeting you there at the Conspiracy Conference, and that'll be just about 2 weeks from now.
Not even quite that long. I'll see you there, and I'd be happy to be on the show whenever you want.
God bless, and thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Stan.
Oh, okay, fine. Well, that was Daniel Sheehan, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation this evening, because certainly Daniel has been on the front lines of this battle. And, you know, everything he said tonight, I think, is absolutely true. Bale. This is Dr. Stan, and I hope you've enjoyed our program this evening with Daniel Sheehan. We could call this an evening with Daniel Sheehan, who's certainly an outstanding lawyer. He certainly led the effort to try to expose the machinations of the Central Intelligence Agency, which I believe, of course, is deeply involved with the dark side. And until we can, of course, get these people, expose them for what they've done and have them start before the bar of justice, why, there will no longer be freedom in America. And, of course, if we don't do it, who will? And if not now, when? Well, I believe time is running out for America, and I really believe we have to be involved. And, of course, we have the unique opportunity to reach people across America, across the world, by Internet, by shortwave, by radio, by satellite. And we do hope that many of you will decide you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us in what we do. And you can do that by giving us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, or you can get a regular copy of our newsletter, subscribe to our newsletter. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, our November and December newsletters, dealt with the fluoride issue and the effort to poison the American people. And certainly our, I believe it was our January newsletter, dealt with book by John Perkins, going into the Confessions of an Economic Hitman. The February newsletter went into the war over in Iraq, and of course the futility of this war, because we're not really fighting terrorism over there. We've been lied to at every turn what this was about, and I think that you'll enjoy our newsletters. You can, of course, go to our website of RadioLiberty.com and pull them down, and we hope you will. If you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get that book. That's The Brotherhood of Darkness. It's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. We have a great new four-tape set on autism. We have a great new four-tape set on mercury, so that gives us the original four-tape set on mercury, and then an update going in, of course, to the latest information we have and how the government officials have been lying to parents and lying to the American people about their knowledge of the fact that there's a direct link between the vaccinations and the mercury and the vaccinations and the neurodevelopmental abnormalities that affects one in every six American children today. We've destroyed a whole generation of our youth. So our mercury update, and then we have an update on chemtrails. So we have actually two four-tape sets on chemtrails, the original one, and then an update, and so much more. We have this four-tape set on depleted uranium. If you want to know about the experiments they've done on our servicemen, why, you need to get the four-tape set, Vaccine A, going into the experiment they did on all of the boys in the Gulf War, which is why over half of them today have physical disabilities. And the government is simply lying, telling them they're all crazy when they know they're not. They just want to follow along this bizarre experiment that they did on over 600,000 of our troops. You need to get the book Vaccine A. You need to get the four-tape set Vaccine A. And then, of course, if you don't believe the experiment on our children, why, you need to get the Rockefeller Committee report out of the Veterans Administration. We call it the Rockefeller Committee report because it came out over the name of Jay Rockefeller. It's inexpensive. It's the information they don't want you to get. They only printed 35 copies of this for the nation of, what, almost 300 million people. Well, we got most of the copies that they printed through the printing office. Those were general distribution, and we print it now ourselves because we want you to get the truth so that you'll think very seriously about sending your children into the military where they'll be used as human guinea pigs. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. But then please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, because we're on the front lines of this battle. So until Monday, when we'll be back with you once again, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.